Okay. Well, welcome. And actually, I went to quite a few W3168 meetings at the beginning without really being a member, so I can't see any reason that someone from industry couldn't just join in. So I thank the organizers for inviting me to talk to you today about collaborative work that I've been doing with three weep readers at Washington State University, working on pre-harvest sprouting tolerance in white wheat and drawing connections to grain dormancy and hormone response. I think I should probably walk with this because it seems like you don't hear me when I turn towards the screen. Okay. So we're interested in wheat. You can see this photograph of Washington State University over here. And it's a university town surrounded by beautiful rolling hills of wheat. So to really appreciate a thing, sometimes you have to think about it backwards. What would it take to invent a seed in the first place? It's a lot like what you would need if you decided that you wanted to send babies out from space capsules to populate other planets, right? You would need to have a fairly tough capsule to resist the sort of stresses they would see along the way. You would need to have a food source to keep the baby going until it was able to get established and function on its own. You would have to have a way to put the baby into suspended animation or to make it dormant. And you'd also need to have a system to wake it up at the appropriate time under conditions where it's likely to be able to survive and settle in a new place. So the research in my lab is a lot about this suspended animation and wake-up system, dormancy and dormancy loss in wheat. And I also will, well, not embarrassed to tell you, I also dabble in Arabidopsis. So the seeds of many temperate species are dormant upon maturity, which is to say that they fail to germinate under conditions that would normally stimulate germination. They can lose dormancy through a number of different processes. For example, after ripening is dormancy loss. Oops. I do this on my own laptop, too. I have a tendency to rub trackpads. So after ripening, which is a period of dry storage during which the seed acquires the ability to germinate, or cold stratification, which is a lot like a wintry condition. It's being moist and vibing water in the cold. So as with all great inventions, we appreciate them most when they go wrong, which can happen in cereals. Many cereals, including wheat, sorghum, barley, have problems with pre-harvest sprouting if rain occurs, if mature grain gets rained on before it's harvested out of the field. So this problem is associated with lack of seed dormancy. McCaig and DePoe actually showed that seed dormancy accounts for 60 to 80% of the variation in this trait. The rest of the variation is due to properties of the flower, of the spike itself. So a tight gloom or a waxy gloom will keep the water out and reduce the probability of pre-harvest sprouting. This causes losses to farmers and to millers to a large extent because during the germination process, that food supply has to be mobilized. So there's induction of alpha amylase, and you get starch damage, which causes poor end-use quality. So why do we have this problem with pre-harvest sprouting? Why hasn't this problem been solved already? I've had farmers ask me that question. This is an old story. Why haven't you guys fixed this yet? The reason is because this has to be balanced against the issue of seedling emergence. You have too much seed dormancy at the time that the seed is planted. It won't emerge well from the soil. And this has a negative impact on yields, both if the seed doesn't come out at all or if it comes up unevenly and the plants shade each other. So straight selection for good emergence and for pre-harvest sprouting and for yield will tend to lead to pre-harvest sprouting susceptibility in a breeding program. The issue of seedling emergence is especially important in semi-arid areas like eastern Washington, which is where I work, because a partially dormant seed needs a higher water potential in order to germinate. So when we select for good germination in a dry place, we select very hard for lack of dormancy. So I just told you that Washington is semi-arid, and some of you are probably saying she's lying. Rainfall in Washington ranges from 12 feet per year in the Olympic Peninsula to 6 inches per year in the deepest part of the Cascade Mountain Ranges rain shadow. There are farmers in Franklin and Adams County who grow wheat with as little as 6 to 9 inches of rainfall per year. So they tend to be pretty courageous about pre-harvest sprouting. That's one of the reasons that Washington grows, the inland Northwest Washington, Oregon, and Idaho grow most of the nation's soft white wheat. So hard red wheat has higher protein and is better for bread. And that red color in the seed coat gives you higher dormancy and better pre-harvest sprouting tolerance. One reason that red wheat is popular. Soft white wheat has lower protein and is better for cakes and cookies, but it just innately has lower seed dormancy and is more prone to pre-harvest sprouting. So we have a tendency to ignore this trait, and we grow white wheat, which means in those rare cases where the wheat gets rained on in Washington close to harvest, it's a complete and total catastrophe because we have very little resistance. So this really tells you that there's a problem with relying on natural rain events in the field to select for pre-harvest sprouting tolerance, both if you have a paucity of events, and also because your susceptibility to pre-harvest sprouting is also going to be influenced by maturity date. So the wheat is not going to sprout if it gets rained on during, say, embryo maturation before maturity, when they're still green in the flower. At the point when the wheat first turns from green to yellow, when it reaches physiological maturity, you have the highest level of seed dormancy and pre-harvest sprouting tolerance. And then dormancy and resistance are lost over time through dry after ripening, and you get increasing pre-harvest sprouting susceptibility. This means that if in your breeding program you rely on a single rain event to try and screen out pre-harvest sprouting susceptibility, you can wind up misinterpreting things. You could, based on this rain event, you could wind up saying that a pre-harvest sprouting tolerant wheat that matured early is more susceptible than a very non-dormant susceptible wheat that matured late. So you need some kind of greenhouse system to even the playing field and get a good read on the problem. So this is done using the spike wetting test to evaluate pre-harvest sprouting tolerance. Wheat spikes are harvested from the field at physiological maturity, allowed to act ripen for 5 days, and then they're stored frozen until they're placed under a greenhouse misting system that mists 6 seconds for every minute. And they're scored over 7 days using the visible sprouting score scale that was developed in the 70s by McMaster and Guerrera. So this is basing pre-harvest sprouting tolerance on visible sprouting. And it also has a benefit in a way in that we do these assays in the spike itself, so those effects of spike morphology are included in this rating. So when we looked at the soft white winter wheat, we found that we had a wide range of susceptibility. We had some wheats that were resistant, but this was our susceptible check. You can see that a lot of our wheat was even more susceptible than the susceptible check that was used back in the 1990s. So we have a lot of work to do. But when I started working with farmers, they weren't so interested in this bike wedding test. What determines whether how much they get paid is something called the falling numbers test, which is really aimed at looking at how much alpha amylase is being induced in response to germination. So the other thing that happens when the farmers are having trouble with pre-harvest sprouting is that they would tell me, my grain is not sprouted. In fact, I have people mailing me sacks of grain telling me they want me to prove that their grain was not sprouted. But actually, their grain was sprouted. It can be very subtle. You may not even get emergence of the radical. You can just see that the embryo is starting to expand. And actually, once this grain dries out again, that embryo retracts back in. And sometimes you get a little crack at the embryo end, and sometimes you don't. So you have high alpha amylase activity, you get starch degradation, and you get a low falling number. The falling number test was invented in the 1960s, and it's based on viscosity. The grain is ground, you weigh out 7 grams, mix it with 25 mils of water, you put it on a shaker that shakes for exactly the same amount of time every time, and then it's placed in a water bath where it's heated to 100 degrees over 60 seconds while a stirrer stirs. Once you hit the 60-second mark, the machine drops the stirrer and measures the number of times in seconds it takes the stirrer to fall through the ganache. If you have long starch chains, you'll make good thick gravy, right? And it'll slow it down. If you have shortened starch chains from alpha amylase activity, the stirrer falls really fast and you get a low falling number. In most of the world, they begin discounting wheat for falling numbers below 250 seconds. In the state of Washington, their grain begins to be discounted for being below 300 seconds. They get discounted by 25 cents for every 25 seconds below 300 seconds, which drives them absolutely crazy because actually the error bar on the falling number test runs between 30 and 50 seconds. They can lose a lot of money today. Farmers will drive from one place to the other place and have the test done multiple times trying to get the highest number. So even at a falling number of 250, you can still bake a good loaf of bread, but once the falling number gets down low, you have problems with with bad rising and large holes. In our sponge cakes that are baked from soft white wheat, as you get more and more alpha amylase, you get more and more trouble with the cakes falling, which is a problem when we sell this grain to Japan. They love to bake these pretty little sponge cakes as gifts. So in response to our farmers, we characterize our sprouted grain for falling numbers, and this data is actually available on the web if you're interested in looking at it. So this is showing you in red falling numbers below 250, falling numbers between 250 and 300, falling numbers over 300, and the weather at the time of the event. You're looking at the high temperature, and then this is proportionate to the amount of rainfall. Fairfield, Washington in 2013 had 1.8 centimeters. Just as the temperatures fell from being in the 30s Celsius down to being, you know, below 16 Celsius. So quite a big drop in temperature. So that drop in temperature is going to give you cold stratification. And once what I found is that wheat is actually really responsive to cold stratification. And the pre-harvest sprouting resistant lines need something like 48 to 72 hours, whereas the susceptible lines only need 6 to 12 hours of cold stratification to break all dormancy. Pullman was a mild pre-harvest sprouting event, much less rain, but still we had this drop in temperature. St. Andrews had more rain than Pullman did at actually around about the same time, but it missed that temperature drop. And we had no problems with little falling numbers there. So that cold stratification really makes a great deal of difference in whether or not we see pre-harvest sprouting. So we were interested in knowing, for the sake of our farmers, how well our sprouting scores reflected susceptibility to low falling number in the field. We were expecting a negative correlation based on previous work done on Canadian wheat by Rhonda Poe. And really, we did not get a significant correlation. When we looked at soft white wheat from Pullman, Washington in 2013, if I dropped this little cluster of wheat that had unbelievably low falling number for the spouting score, then I could get a significant correlation. But what we learned out of this is that as we go forward doing association mapping, we're going to treat falling number and sprouting score as separate traits as we do association mapping to see how much they are controlled by the same genes. So I am sort of a seed biologist. I know Mark would call me a seed biologist, but I'm also a hormone person and a geneticist. So when I got into this project, I wanted to know how I could use my knowledge of hormone signaling and the awesome power of genetics to address this problem. He's laughing in the back. He makes fun of my awesome power of genetics. So what you need to understand is that seed germination is governed by two hormones, ascitic acid and gibberellins. ADA, during seed maturation, sets up seed dormancy, and it inhibits the germination of mature grain and pulls towards seed tolerance, towards pre-harvest starting tolerance. Gibberellins can break dormancy in partially dormant seeds and stimulate germination, so they grow towards emergence. So I reasoned that if you had an ADA hypersensitive wheat mutant, it would be like having more members on the ABA side of the tug of war, and it would pull the balance towards pre-harvest sprouting tolerance. So in designing this mutant screen, though, it's important to understand that the sensitivity to these hormones varies with after-ripening in wheat. As a pre-harvest sprouting tolerant cultivar after-ripens, first, it acquires more sensitivity to germination stimulation by GA, and as it after ripens, it also begins to lose sensitivity to ABA. By the time we get out to, say, 6 months of after ripening, we have very little sensitivity to ABA. So the way this screen was done by Lucia Strader and Sven Nelson is they screened after ripened grain. So first we mutagenized with the MS, advanced to N2, screened after ripened N2, for failure to germinate on 5 micromolar ABA. We moved these to plates without ABA and looked for the ones that germinated and then retested in subsequent generations. And what we found was that we had one really strongly ABA hypersensitive line called ERA8 for enhanced response to ABA8 that is a semi-dominant mutation in soft white spring ZAC. So Chantel Martinez was interested in the effect on ERA8 in hormone sensitivity with after ripening, and she was also interested to know whether this phenotype was due to increased ADA signaling or an increase in ADA hormone accumulation. And she teamed up with Keiko Tuttle and Rican scientist Mitsunori Sale on this. So Chantel did an after-ripening time course comparing the ERA8 mutant in red and the wild-type ZAC, and you can see that initially ERA8 is insensitive to gibberellins, but it does acquire GA sensitivity as it after-ripens. Initially also, ERA8 can't germinate, but you can reach a reasonable amount of germination within, say, 8 to 10 weeks of after-ripening. The sensitivity of the mutant to ABA is very high, continues to be lower than wild type here through 16 weeks of after ripening, but Elizabeth Strong took this out to 3 years. If you raise the amount of ABA, you can still see a difference out at 3 years of after ripening. So Chantel took 3 time points at 1, 4, and 10 weeks of after ripening, and we also have to keep in mind that these represented different stages in dormancy loss. such that 1 week of after ripening, ERA 8 is more dormant, say, than wild-type sap at 1 week of after ripening. And we looked at ADA hormone levels in these lines. What I was interested to see was that with after ripening, both the mutants and the wild-type showed decreasing ADA hormone levels. That means that the mutant is able to turn over ADA. So it's not just a complete knockout, say, of ADA turnover. Initially, I was thinking that the phenotype was due to ADA overaccumulation because I saw that at 4 weeks and also at 10 weeks, there was more, significantly more ADA in the mutant than in the wild type. But then we started thinking about it actually in terms of the germination phenotype. So at a point where you have similar ADA, endogenous ADA levels, the mutant is actually more dormant than the wild type. At a point where there's more ADA in the wild type than the mutant, you have similar amounts of dormancy. So I actually think that this mutant is probably a defect in ADA signaling as opposed to control of the accumulation of the hormone. And if we try to clone this using bulk segregant RNA-seq analysis, we're going to be looking for candidate genes that are involved in ADA signaling, for example, the ADA receptor or phosphatases and kinases involved in the signaling pathway. So, but the real crux of the matter is, does ERA8 actually improve pre-harvest sprouting tolerance? And we addressed this over 3 years with the help of Mark Sorrell using the spike wetting test. In each of the years that we looked at this, here's wild type, here's mutant. Mutant always has a much lower sprouting score than wild type. In 2012, we were able to compare this sprouting score to other soft white varieties, and we found that the mutant had comparable pre-harvest sprouting tolerance to our pre-harvest sprouting tolerance checks. So you can affect sprouting score. I will admit, I haven't been able to test the effect of this mutant on falling number yet because I haven't had it in the field when there's been a sprouting event. So, we can improve pre-harvest sprouting tolerance by selecting for increased ADA sensitivity. And since I have a few minutes left, I always speak faster when I get to talk than when I practice it. Oh, that's okay. Better too fast than too slow, right? We've found, looking at different varieties, that the ADA sensitivity also correlates to pre-harvest sprouting tolerance over multiple soft white varieties. So I think you can use screening for higher ADA sensitivity as a way to select for pre-harvest sprouting tolerance. Our future direction on this is going to be to find markers linked to ADA, to ERA8, or better yet, to clone the gene using bulk segregant RNA-seq. Mostly because when you start talking to wheat breeders about plating things and selecting for hormone sensitivity, it sounds too fussy to them. Also, when you're doing crosses between different backgrounds, you wind up with more than just the ERA8 gene affecting the phenotype, and you don't get a straight answer on whether or not you're following the gene. So we're going to need to have good linked markers in order to deploy this gene. The nice thing about this gene is that it gives higher seed dormancy, but it still after ripens pretty quickly. Some of those pre-harvest sprouting tolerant checks that we use need on the order of 3 to 6 months to after ripen, whereas this mutant can after ripen in 8 to 10 weeks, which means that you could use it in winter wheat. With the winter wheat, they often harvest it and then turn around and plant it 8 to 10 weeks later in order to get their winter crop in. So this is important for them. The other thing that we've learned is that the sprouting score is not always tightly correlated to falling number. So I have a collaborative project that was just funded with Nepal, working with Aaron Carter and Jiwoo Jang to do genome-wide association mapping, not just for sprouting score, but also for falling number, And we're going to be exploring emergence. Aaron does this routinely in his breeding program, because we want to be able to find the genetics that gives you that nice balancing point between pre-harvest sprouting tolerance and emergence, so that you don't sacrifice too much yield to prevent that once in every 5-year disaster with pre-harvest sprouting tolerance. And with that, I'll take your questions. Oh, I should thank all these people. I'm sorry, I put this slide in and I forgot about them. Chantal Martinez is the person working with Area 8. Keiko Tuttle has been working on hormone measurements. Tracy Harris is basically my lab manager extraordinaire. And these are folks who have been students in my lab and have left. And these folks, timeless people who have helped with recent work. My collaborators are Kim Garland Campbell of USDA ARS, Aaron Carter of Washington State University, Michael Pumphrey, Mark Sorrell has been very helpful to us in discussing the spike wetting test, and Misa Nori Seo of the Regen Institute, who helped us with hormone measurements. This work has been primarily funded by the Washington Grain Commission, also with help from NSF-EC, USDA ARS, and now in the future we will be funded by NIFA. Thank you. He's asked me if you can find the genes responsible for seed dormancy in the red wheat. Actually, those genes were cloned by Kimmy et al. The gene is wheat or TA-MID, a transcription factor that controls the production of the red pigment. The pigment itself, whether or not you make the pigment, is what controls whether or not red wheat has seed dormancy. But there is a project being done by Andy. Oh, I hate it when I blank on people's names. Folks in England, sorry. they have a project where they're looking at the biosynthesis pathway for the red pigmentation. And they're hoping that they can find an alternative mutation for going from red to white that would lead you later in the red pigmentation biosynthesis pathway and accumulate compounds that don't look red, but still would give you seed dormancy. So I'm very curious to see how that turns out for them. So this is a good idea. Yes?
Are hard whites comparable to the soft whites in terms of pre-harvest crops?
And actually, hard whites have a tendency to be more pre-harvest sprouting susceptible than soft whites because we haven't been growing them as long. So what in the breeding process, usually what happens is you do a hard red to soft white cross, and then you select a white wheat out of that that has good baking qualities. But it's not the hardness or the high protein that makes you pre-harvest sprouting resistant. It's other genes, and there's been no selection there for dormancy. So basically, you have a hard red wheat where you've taken away that red gene, and you haven't selected for any alternative ways, say higher ADA sensitivity, to be pre-harvest sprouting tolerant. Does that make sense? Because basically, a white wheat needs to do it some other way than being red. Yes?
Given the following numbers, the compound measurement of both the condition of the starch and the alpha amylase activity, would it be helpful to you to just measure the alpha amylase activity?
Yeah, actually we're doing that, and one of the slides I took out shows you At least in our soft white winters, we have a very strong correlation between alpha amylase enzyme activity and falling number. But when you talk to farmers or you talk to seed people, they really want to know what the falling number is. They're used to it, it's historical, and I can use this as a tool in my research program, or I can use it as a tool in the breeding program. But what they want to know at the end of the day is what the falling number is. The falling number is influenced by other things. So this correlation looks really nice in our soft white winters. It's not so nice in our soft white springs, because people have intentionally introduced genes for partial waxy, which is to say to have more amylopectin as opposed to amylose, that's the starch in the seed. And it looks like amylopectin is more susceptible to alpha amylase. So for a very small amount of alpha amylase, you wind up with a much lower falling number. And you get a much more scattered looking correlation when you look at alpha amylase versus falling number. You're like giving me excuses to talk about slide that took out. Thank you very much. There's more than one trait affecting this. It's also being affected, as I said, by starch properties. So, like I said, amylose is more resistant than amylopectin to the alpha amylase enzyme. It's also affected. We purposely use the spike wedding test so that the spike morphology traits are included in the equation. Really, the falling number test does not take those into account. So in some ways, we've purposely, do you see what I mean? We've kind of purposely skewed towards that. The other thing is that you should keep in mind that my falling numbers tests are always done on field sprout events. And those are subject to those variabilities for maturity date. And I've taken that out of the equation when I've done my spike wedding test. So in some ways, I've messed with it myself.
Does germination, the speed of germination, fall into that category, a bigger measurement as well?
I haven't looked at that. That's a good question. Or there could just be differences in how quickly some varieties induce alpha amylase with germination. I mean, are some of them waiting until after radical emergence itself, while others are actually starting to induce the enzyme before the embryo starts to emerge? And maybe in the process of selecting for great seedling vigor and emergence, we might be driving it intentionally towards those ones that induce alpha amylase earlier, maybe mobilizing the starch faster is giving us really good seedling vigor and helping those seeds to emerge from deep planting in dry soils.
I'd like to follow up on that. I've been looking at Bob Brabosch's data where he used the leaf area meter to read the sprouting following the wedding test. And I think that might help you get at all of those timing issues rather than just the straight numerical 1-9 scores, but to get that kind of data on how advanced the sprouting is.
We let him get this one, or I'm probably way over.
Okay, you're about time. All right, we'll have some time at the end. You know, it's a short symposium.
I'll hang out.
So
we'll talk.